Welcome back to Radio Physics, a collaboration with the Aspen Center for Physics, KDNK Community Radio in Carbondale, and physics students from local high schools and beyond. Interns spend 2 weeks working at the center during the summer and get to talk one-on-one to some of the prominent physicists who are here. I'm Marisa Walbert, and I'm hosting today's episode, which is being recorded here at the Aspen Center for Physics. Our intern today is Alice Lebedev-Nigdal. She is a rising junior at St. Anne's School in Brooklyn Heights, New York. Today, she will be interviewing Ned Wingreen. Ned is the Howard A. Pryor Professor of the Life Sciences at Princeton University. He is a member of the Department of Molecular Biology and Associate Director of the Lewis Sigler Institute for Integrative Genomics, where he is the Director of Graduate Studies of the QCB Graduate Program. He is also the Associate Director of the Princeton Center for Theoretical Science and Associate Faculty in the Department of Physics. Ned received his PhD in Theoretical Condensed Matter Physics from Cornell University in 1989. He did his postdoc in Mesoscopic Physics at MIT before moving in 1991 to the NEC Research Institute in Princeton. At NEC, he continued to work in Mesoscopic Physics, but also started research in biophysics, where he grew into the general interest in problems at the interface of physics and biology. Ned joined Princeton University in 2004, and his current research focuses on modeling of bacteria, bacterial communities, phages, and other microorganisms, as well as the study of intercellular phase separation and topics in immunology. He is a fellow of the American Physical Society and the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Take it away, Alice.
So, I feel like I heard in your intro a lot about physics, and then almost only towards the end, like, biology started to get mentioned. So, what did the path to becoming a biophysicist look like?
So, my way into biology, as in so many important things, had a randomness to it. I was at this NEC Research Institute, which was a great place to work while it lasted. Funded by a Japanese company, and eventually the Japanese were not making as much money and decided that they didn't need this institute. But while we were there, we were very free. I had a budget, and I had a budget which was enough to hire half a postdoc. But I had a colleague who also had a budget that was enough to hire half a postdoc. So we realized that if we got together, we could hire a whole postdoc. And so we had done that, and they were looking for some new problem to work on. They were coming from a statistical physics background, looking at complex systems. And I had a day job. I was pretty happy with the job I was doing quantum calculations for mesoscopic systems, small semiconductors with single electrons going through transistors. Mm-hmm. So when they started talking about this, it really wasn't of interest to me, particularly because it was in Chinese. So they were discussing some new topic, which was proteins. However, it turned out they were in the office next to me, and about every fifth word they were using was not Chinese, it was English. So I heard Chinese, 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 free energy, Chinese, 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 landscape, Chinese, 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 funnel. And after about an hour of this, I realized that I wasn't getting any work done because I was trying to understand what they were saying, but I couldn't really. And so I went next door and they said, well, we're starting to look at proteins as a complex system. Maybe there's something for physicists here. And I put up my hands and I said, oh, that's biology. All irreproducible results, messy, no self-respecting physicist would ever touch this stuff. And they then said, well, you know, there may be something to that, but if you look at these protein structures, people have learned how to do X-ray crystallography and NMR, and these are really, you know, written in stone. We know what these protein structures are. No irreproducible results here. And maybe there are some questions that physicists could address. And I was still very skeptical. But they convinced me to read some papers on the topic, and I found some paper from a colleague, Ken Dill, who is an instrumental thinker in this field, where a protein was modeled as a walk on a cubic lattice, and only two types of residues in this protein instead of the natural 20. And I thought, well, that looks a lot like physics to me, because it looked like kind of models that physicists studies for magnets, like the Ising model. And so I said, well, I don't know if this has anything to do with biology, but I'm willing to think about it, particularly because I'm paying half of this postdoc salary. I should give names. The postdoc was Hao Li. He's now a prominent professor at UCSF, and my colleague is Chao Tang, who now runs many institutes in China. Chao has gone back to China to help science there. But that was the beginning of a very slippery slope. And so starting with that as a hobby, as a side interest, over the next few years, I slid all the way into a molecular biology department at Princeton. And now my group does exclusively work in biology and biophysics, albeit still as theorists and modelers. That was my direction in physics, and it continues to be my direction. And I've never felt the need to build a lab because I have so many wonderful experimental colleagues at Princeton and elsewhere who really know what they're doing, and they have been wonderful collaborators. So we handle theory and modeling, they handle experiments, but together I think we're definitely more than the sum of the parts.
So how does exactly your research look like, and how does it combine the two fields? You kind of already touched on this, but do you think you could go a bit deeper into that?
Yeah, I can try. And of course, this depends case by case. I mean, one thing that I would say is super important is that we formed a number of very long-term, fantastic collaborations. So in fact, the reason that I'm at Princeton is because at a formative meeting in Mexico City, I met someone at the airport who was then an assistant professor at Princeton, a woman named Bonnie Bassler. And I said, oh, you know, how are you? Are you a Princeton professor? And she said, yes. What are you? And I said, I'm a physicist. And she said, what are you doing at this meeting? Are you interested in two-component systems? And I said, what's a two-component system? And she said, that's what this meeting is about. And so she was very nice to me. She sat with me on the bus on the three-hour drive it took to get to the conference center and told me all about two-component systems and her work in quorum sensing, how bacteria talk to each other to behave like multicellular organisms. And that was the beginning of a collaboration that's now gone on for decades. Mm. I should say that Bonnie is a superstar scientist. That was clear even at the time as an assistant professor, but the world has since recognized that. She's winner of many prizes. She's a Howard Hughes medical investigator. She's a MacArthur genius, has just ended 12 years as chair of molecular biology. And so we've been working together for a very long time, but the problems we're working on keep evolving. So as her group makes new discoveries in this area of bacterial communication, when appropriate, my group and hers collaborate to build in a theoretical and a modeling side that complements the experiments that they're doing in the lab. And I should say, our collaboration with Bonnie is one of many collaborations that we've formed over the years. One that's very productive is with Zemer Gitai, who will be here next week as part of a working group working on bacterial cell physiology and cell biology. And Zemer's interest has moved into phages, which is the topic of our working group, something else we're working on. And so I consider these collaborations the gift that keeps on giving, right? That we keep working with the same great scientists and they keep coming up with interesting discoveries and interesting puzzles that keep the theorists occupied.
So this is kind of just like it's a bit of a weird question, but do you feel like life follows a predictable pattern? And if so, what might that suggest about the bigger picture of the universe? And if not, how are you able to model and predict in your research?
So, you know, while my life may not follow a predictable pattern, I do have the sense that life as a whole is generally following a predictable pattern. I would track that down to the ideas of metabolism, at least, from the microscopic level. There are really strong constraints on what life can look like. I think it was described that life is an electron looking for a place to rest. And that's the idea that there are processes that create high energy compounds, obviously the energy, most of it ultimately coming from the sun, from solar energy, and that life is taking advantage of high energy electrons and finding places where they can go that will release energy in the process. And there's a finite number of these. That's why we have the same metabolism that bacteria have. We're all fundamentally processing the same high energy compounds and taking advantage of the energy that's then released. Of course, an energy has to come from somewhere, and wonderfully, photosynthesis was evolved by organisms. So we have a tremendous flow of energy coming into our planet from the sun, captured by trees and algae and bacteria. that make it possible for animals like us, who are simply users of these high-energy electron compounds. But again, the basic processes are the same and are constrained by chemistry. The fact that we have certain atoms, carbon, oxygen, nitrogen to play with, and there are certain compounds that are natural to make from these and to process metabolically. Now, does that mean that if we ran the tape of life over again, you'd see people? Not necessarily. I think you would see something that looked a lot like bacteria, and probably based on work, for example, by my colleague Bonnie and others, that bacteria tend to start behaving like multicellular organisms, that there are advantages. We'd see some multicellular creatures, but whether they would look like us or some other, something else would be up for grabs. And of course, we have the advantage that we have a very stable environment. There's some estimates of how rare it is for a planet like ours to have the right temperature, the right amount of water, and so on, for life to have enough time to evolve to multicellular organisms like ourselves. But I'm definitely a believer that we're not unique. I think that there has been life elsewhere, and even intelligent life elsewhere in the universe, because the universe is really, really huge.
Yeah. What is the most interesting thing that you've managed to find in your work with microbial systems and bacteria?
So I guess for me, it's not something that I found, but I do think that the fact that bacteria are not loners, and this is work, Bonnie has been a leader, but this work was going on before her. She made some seminal discoveries, for example, that bacteria are not just talking among themselves within a species, but across species, and they're actually talking to us with small molecules.
Oh, wow.
There is interkingdom communication where the bacteria talk to eukaryotes like us. And also the phages, the viruses that infect bacteria, are eavesdropping on these bacterial communications and, in fact, doing their own communicating with small molecules. So the microbial world is filled with chatter, which is based on, you know, small diffusible molecules which are produced and then sensed. And that gives bacteria information about their environment, how many are there, who's there, and that helps them decide how to behave, what genes to turn on so that they can adapt to that environment.
Are we able to know what they're saying and just...
To some extent, and it turns out that their conversations are rather rich. Many bacteria use multiple signals, so they're able to carry different information, different mixes of those signals. Bacteria, as I said, are listening to each other's signals, communicating, also interfering with each other's signals. Some of the bacteria are in many ways competing with each other. And so one way to do that is to block or scramble each other's signals. So I think as far as microbiology is concerned, there are many, many fascinating things. But the fact that bacteria, far from our early picture of these cells that were just loners and would swim around and eat things and make more of themselves, They're really social organisms.
What kind of breakthroughs do you think can only happen at the intersection of biology and physics?
That's a great question. That's what I ask myself every day. And I think that increasingly biology is looking more and more quantitative. The questions are evolving from sort of what questions, like what is the gene or the protein that does this? What is the organism that, you know, is living in the soil that does such and such, to how questions? And as soon as you get into how questions about how biological systems work at the molecular level, first off, it has to be very quantitative. There are not really a lot of yes, no questions you can ask. You have to really understand how these machines work. And that's a really great opportunity for physics, because the bacteria and our cells, they don't know that they're supposed to use biological solutions or even what that means. They're using physics and chemistry all the time to solve their problems. And so this is a great place for people with a physics background and a physics perspective, as well as people with other quantitative backgrounds, to complement the experiments that happen in biology labs and the kind of questions that biologists are asking.
So what kind of advice do you have for, like, people my age, like high schoolers that want to combine like two fields that maybe, I don't know, aren't easy, that's not an easy thing to do, kind of, with the amount of resources that I have?
Well, I would definitely aim to do it, I think that combining fields is the place where you know, great breakthroughs are going to happen. I wouldn't, on the other hand, I wouldn't put too much pressure on yourself. I feel like I learned almost zero biology as a high school student, and I learned exactly zero as a college student because I took no biology courses. I was very skeptical about biology. At that point, I had sort of drunk the Kool-Aid of physics is the fundamental science, and anything that's not pressing the limits of physics understanding is not, you know, worth really working that hard on. I've completely changed. I completely believe that that there's fascination, emergent properties at all scales. There's nothing special about strings compared to chains of bacteria. Strings as in string theory.
Yeah.
They're all the right level of description at their scale. I think the advice I would give to young people is to make choices that maintain your flexibility. So if you think that by studying, you know, maybe more math, it was going to keep your flexibility because math is used in a lot of places, then I would say, yeah, focus on the things that you think are going to give you the most options later on, because the world is changing, science is changing, your interests are changing. But if you have, if you're prepared in a way that makes you flexible, then you're in a great position to take advantage of those changes.
So kind of to finish up, you obviously know way more about your field than I do. So is there something that you wish that I had asked you about today, or just something that you didn't have a chance to talk about?
That's a good question. I think you could ask, do I have any, you know, general advice for young people coming into science, which you sort of have asked about trying to combine things. What I would say is you want to find something you're excited about day to day, right? Because until rather late in your career, really it's about your own education. It's about your own, you know, finding the thing that drives you, your motivation. But it's education in a general sense. I even tell this to my graduate students, or you mentioned, director of graduate studies. People are very worried, oh, is this the right topic I should work on? Oh, maybe I won't be interested in this in 10 years. And I say, nobody knows what they're going to be interested in science in 10 years. You want to be in a situation where you're interested right now. And as a graduate student, and certainly as a college student or as a high school student, you're learning general skills. You're learning the basic math, physics, chemistry, biology. As a graduate student, you're learning how to do science. How do you start a project? How do you collaborate with people? How do you write for a general audience? Don't start worrying about what you're going to do in your career until you've got your PhD. At that point, you should be prepared by making good choices, working in a lab that's supportive, where you like the people, where you get good guidance from your principal investigator and you're excited. Then you'll be in a great position to make the decisions about what it is that you really want to achieve in your career.
Obviously, like, in this world that we live in, depending on the region that you live in, you have a different language. Is that, like, the same with the bacteria? Like, do you see what I'm saying? Like, in terms of, like, do they all kind of speak, or...
Interesting question.
Yeah.
There are language groups within the bacteria, just like there are language groups in humans. Okay. So there's certain types of molecules that are common signals. So there are largely two classes of bacteria.
Uh-huh.
They're called gram-negative and gram-positive because of how they stain. But the one of them, they're very different, and they branched, you know, a billion years ago. One of them has a thick cell wall, and it takes this gram stain, and the other one has a thin cell wall, but usually an extra membrane, so it doesn't. But they tend to communicate with different molecules. So the gram-negatives use things called homoserine lactones, but there's a whole family of them, just like if you were thinking about the Romance languages. There is Italian and French and so on, whereas the others use peptides, which are like mini proteins. And again, each of these gram-positive bacteria uses its own group of these peptides. That's like a very different language group. whether, you know, sometimes there are cross communications, but you can find these general themes. And of course, in some ways, it's easier to make variants. Like you can mm-hmm. imagine how, oh, if you're communicating with one peptide, a small mutation in your genome could change the sequence of that, and now that branches off a new dialect mm-hmm. that you can speak. Whereas similar things happen in the gram negatives with the chemistry that's building these small molecules. Small changes in the enzymes could add another carbon to this signal, and that changes its properties, changes how you communicate. And there's lots of pressures, for example, to add additional ways of communicating. So adding different dialects. So as I mentioned, many of these bacteria are multilingual.
Yeah. So are bacteria that like don't typically use a certain molecule to communicate, are they still able to receive that molecule and understand it?
Great question. Yeah, there are definitely examples of bacteria that are eavesdropping, that are listening into other communications, not making the signals themselves. So almost everything you can imagine having in a conversation is happening at these molecular levels among the bacteria.
So what kind of things are they telling each other?
Oh, they're telling each other, one of the main things they're telling each other is, are there enough of us to undertake collective activities? So there are, for example, certain things that are very costly. Making an enzyme that would be secreted and digest some food source, where if one bacteria by itself secretes this enzyme, it's a little bit of digestion, but it's probably unlikely to capture any of the benefit of that. Those molecules will diffuse away. Mm. On the other hand, if there's a large population of these same bacteria, now it makes sense for them each to produce these enzymes. That will make that will degrade the food source into a form that they can eat, and then collectively they'll be able to eat those small molecules. So they're constantly sensing, are we in a large population where we can do these collective activities productively, or are we alone where we better behave in a very different way? Now, of course, there are nuances to that. Are we in a large population that are kin, or are there competing bacteria? Are there related bacteria? There are all sorts of gradations of this. But that's certainly one of the things. And it's actually very important for human health because, for example, there are bacteria that cause diseases like Vibrio cholera, which causes mm-hmm. cholera, that its communication with itself to decide if there's enough of them is a signal for it to attack us as a host. So Vibrio cholera that have communication blocked are not virulent. They're unable to cause disease. So one of the main long-range goals of the study is to develop cures for bacterial diseases that would be based on interfering, for example, or controlling these quorum-sensing communications. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So what separates like bacteria that are competing with each other versus bacteria that are helping each other? Is it just like based on like strain and like type of bacteria?
So by and large, you know, bacteria sort of are all about their own species, I would say. There are situations where they end up being, you know, collaborating in something. Maybe metabolically, there are examples of that where there's a series of bacteria that perform subsequent steps in some metabolic process. And actually each one is necessary for the survival of the others. But they're definitely opportunists. They're definitely, you know, all about supporting their kin, their identical clonal communities. Whether they will ever collaborate with others is case by case. More typically, they're competing among the species.
How can they tell if another bacteria is part of their own species or?
There are mixes of different signals. And for example, a certain mix of chemical signals will say, oh, that we interpret as we're surrounded by very close kin. Whereas a different mix might mean this is a related species. It's another Vibrio, but it's not Vibrio cholera. And we're competitors with those.
Mm. What do you like do in your free time? Like outside of just...
Thank you for asking. So despite my advanced years, I am still an enthusiastic athlete.
Oh, wow.
I wouldn't say a quality athlete, but enthusiasm makes up for that. So I love playing Ultimate Frisbee and soccer, as well as other sports when those two are not available.
Oh, yeah. I heard you are a big organizer of soccer games.
I'm going to organize some games for next week. if you're around, please come out and join us.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much for your time today. We hope you enjoyed this Radio Physics. For more information on our internship program and events at the Aspen Center for Physics, please visit our website at aspenphys.org or follow us on social at aspenphysics. Thank you.